You remembered them fondly, and then they were gone. And now you want to know who, what, where, when, why it ended with Robbie E. and Matt Coon.
Hey, what's up, guys? So we're back this week. It's hashtag Why It Ended Wednesday, and I'm super pumped up for today's interview. But before we get to that, before we get to this big week that I got going on, that Matt, you got going on, what about our interview last week?
Our interview last week was fantastic. We had Tony Schiavone. And a lot of people said, even though, you know, I somewhat know him a little bit, that I was a bit of a fanboy, and it was cool to see me so into the interview. I know you enjoyed the interview, too. Isn't it great to be with somebody who knows how to talk?
Yeah, no, it was entertaining listening to him. You could tell he does it for a living. But I could also tell that you were sweaty under your armpits. I could just feel it through the microphone.
Well, it was, you know, Tuesday. So, you know, that's usually what happens. Hey, and if you guys want to know what happens, check out our Why It Ended Patreon. We are adding stuff every day, bonus shows every month. Plus, I think we might have our live show up there pretty soon from Jimmy's Famous Seafood. So give us a follow on Twitter at Why It Ended, at Matt Coon Music, at Robert Strauss. And make sure to check out our Patreon, support our show, because we are trying to keep this podcast going as long as we can. Robbie, what's going on in your life besides the stuff I know is going on?
Well, the announcement's finally made, so you can't make any more corny jokes. I am a part of the Titan Games on NBC, debuting January 3rd. It's the first episode. The Rock is the host, one of the most tried out for reality shows in history. I'm proud to be a part of it, and it's going to be a can't miss show on Thursday nights in January, NBC. The Rock and Robbie E. I mean, come on, how perfect is that?
I mean, everybody has always wondered what happened. What would happen if The Rock and Robbie E got together? Like, it's just this question. Like, we never really got to see Flair and Hogan for the title, but we can see The Rock and Robbie E on NBC. Now, Robbie,
Flair and Hogan never wrestled for the title?
Not at Mania. Yeah. The way, you know, it's a long story. But anyway, yeah. For yourself in this show, of course, you couldn't say it outright, you know, you probably were prohibited from it. But when it came to tell us about the Titan Games, what is this fucking thing? What is this show?
It's basically, I would say, it's from the makers of American Ninja Warrior. And I would kind of say it's like American Gladiators on steroids. It's just the obstacles and the things involved are so crazy. You're going to get a kick out of watching me do them. So it's going to be, but I mean, you can't forget is whatever as I am pretty fit. So I'm going to hang in there. But I am going against some of the best athletes in the world. There's some really fit people in this thing that they found from all over the world. And it's going to be one of the biggest challenges of my life. But, I mean, the winner gets some cash, and I'm planning on winning this thing, Matt.
So, I mean, I'm going to have to watch this thing, and I'm going to cheer for you every single week. One thing that I thought was really impressive about this show was that it's one of the most auditioned for shows in the history of television. 80,000 auditions, is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, you got to think, who's the biggest guy right now, The Rock? I mean, anything The Rock touches is gold. And I mean, this was no different. So when he's hosting a reality show and the whole concept's like his and his baby, I mean, everybody's going to want to be a part of it.
But you must feel pretty good about making the show with 80,000
people. I'm already a winner. I mean, to make it, to be casted on the show that all these people tried out for and to know I got this far, it's unbelievable.
Now, talking about winners, we have a guest coming up on the show today that we have been trying to get for a long time. He's one of our most requested guests, and he's a really interesting story, and that is Chris Masters. Now, what do you know of Chris Masters? What are you looking for in this interview?
He's got a good story in and out of WWE. You know, he was in and out once, then back again, and then you know, he had his little TNA run. He actually, years ago, I wrestled him in a dark match in a tryout when he first left WWE one of the times. So it'll be funny to talk about that again because I just actually remembered it a little while ago.
And he's never been the same ever since.
He's never been the same because I beat him, which is a rare thing for me to get a win. But
Did you beat him with the punch, the kick, or the choke?
You know, I wish I could remember. Maybe a hard buckle. I don't know. But it was one of those four. Or roll up with tights.
Roll up with tights. I think we have a winner. Now, Robbie, What have you got going on this weekend?
This weekend, Saturday, it's House of Hardcore in Philly. The show is stacked. The afternoon's a convention. I'll be signing it, actually representing Why It Ended. Matt, is there a chance you're coming down, Matt?
Like I told my son, it's looking like a solid 80% chance I'm coming up to Philly for the convention. And, of course, to see Tommy Dreamer's House of Hardcore. And you are facing who this time?
Yeah, well, I'll be teaming up with Tyrus, and we're going against RJ City and David Arquette. So it's going to be a tag match to remember, because that's kind of an odd four pairing. So who knows what wacky stuff will happen. But Philly's going to be off the hook. I'm excited to get a cheesesteak, and I'm excited to see the rowdy crowd.
And you got any other shows you're going to be wrestling at that weekend?
No, just this Saturday. Wow. The convention and the show.
It's a full day. And close to home, so maybe you get to see a little bit more of your family for a change.
Oh, yeah. Friday night's date night, Sunday's family day. I'm looking forward to it.
Last weekend, you wrestled in Milwaukee, is that correct?
I was in Puerto Rico Thursday, Milwaukee Friday and Saturday.
Dude, that's freaking nuts. That's crazy. All right, well, speaking of nuts, coming up now, we have a crazy story. The story of Chris Masters.
I'm wide-ended.
Hello, this is Brent, owner of PleasurePronictsUSA.com. And with the holidays coming, we have a new special offer for the wide-ended listener. Visit StopUsingYourHand.com/booty and pick up one of our top-selling products. Regularly priced $160 for only $95. And that $95 includes free shipping. This realistic booty replica is made from soft, realistic cyber flesh and features two uniquely textured entry points for maximum pleasure. If a little booty's not going to do it for you, we still have the free stroker promotion as well. Visit StopUsingYourHand.com/promo and enter the code FISTBUMP. That's right, Robbie does the fist bump, and so can you with this free stroker. All you have to pay is $6.95 for shipping and handling. Take advantage of one of these promotions today or visit StopUsingYourHand.com and check out our other exciting products, including our flagship, the 3V Starlet Stroker. That's right. Have you ever wanted to be with a porn star? Now you can with a 3V Starlet Stroker. Have vibration. Have that voice of sexy Lauren Phillips or Sarah J or six other adult superstars send you over the top with the 3V Starlet Stroker. Come on, guys. Check your ego at the door. You know everybody does it. Why deprive yourself of satisfaction when Pleasure Products USA cares about your privacy? Your order will arrive in plain packaging, and your credit card statement will not reflect an adult product was purchased. So what are you waiting for? Visit StopUsingYourHand.com today. And remember, Pleasure Products USA, our business is your pleasure.
All right, guys, joining us today, we have Chris Mordetsky, but you might know him as Chris Adonis, and you definitely know him as the masterpiece Chris Masters. Thanks for joining us today, Chris. We really appreciate it.
What's going on, guys? Great intro. Great intro. Beautiful.
Hey, dude. Well, thanks for doing this. I know it's taken a few weeks because you were traveling to, you were in the UK, you were in India, you were all over the place. But we finally got it locked down. I'm excited. But I wanted to ask you, because I remembered today when I was thinking of stuff to talk to you about throughout this interview, I remembered that I don't even know when, probably 5 or 6 years ago, SoCal Val told me that when you guys were like 13 or 14, you met in an audience at Raw and ended up going on a date later. Is that true?
Yeah, actually it is. And she has a better memory of what we did. I thought we went to go see a movie, but I do remember we hung out, and obviously she's SoCal Val, and I was born and raised in Santa Monica and that whole area. And, you know, at the time it probably seemed like a match made in heaven.
What, you guys were just randomly at wrestling shows and like started talking and became friends or something?
Yeah, I mean, I'm hazy when it comes to details because that feels like five lifetimes ago now. Yeah. She'd probably have a better recollection, but I do. I just remember that I met her before I'd ever made it, and then eventually, I was in, you know, WWE, and then she popped up again, and all of a sudden she was in the business, which was, and then we saw each other, and there was obviously a little of an awkward moment, but also you know, kind of a cool moment because you see someone, you know, who's also made it into the business that you didn't expect to ever see again, or let alone make it into, you know, pro wrestling, you know, as far as we did.
And when you actually did start wrestling, you were super young, right?
Yeah. I started training at 16, but then I got injured within like 4 months. Like Cena and me started the same day, actually. He's a bit older, though, obviously. And then when I hurt my ankle, I took 2 years off, and then I came back at about 18 years old. And then that's when everything kind of kicked in the gear. Within a year, I was signed, and I went to OVW.
And with someone breaking in at 16 or starting to train at 16, you must have been someone who was passionate about wrestling. You were a big fan when you were younger?
Oh, yeah. I loved it my whole life. I mean, pretty much like, it's all I've ever known, pretty much. Like, since 1988, I kind of fell in love with it. Right around the time Hogan and Warrior kind of went at it, you know, Warrior got me watching. And then from that point on, I mean, I had a brief stint where I stopped watching in like 1993 for maybe a year or 2 years, but then it just pulled me right back in. You know, I got pulled in by a storyline, and I remember when I started watching again, that was right around the time they had the Iron Man match with Shawn and Bret, which was like the greatest thing I've ever seen. And, you know, so, I mean, I was a lifer from that point.
So when you finally started training, when you came back, you were 18. How did you even break your ankle when you were 16? Was there like just on something random in training?
You know what? It was a leapfrog. I was leapfrogging a guy named Andrew Bernardsky. If you've ever watched the movie The Program, the football movie, he's a big dude on there. And he's been on a lot of other movies. But, you know, basically I was just leapfrogging over him, and I didn't clear him. So I ended up landing awkwardly on my ankle, and I fractured it. I didn't know it. I kept going for a good few weeks with my ankle feeling real bad, and then eventually I got it checked out, and I had to have, like, microscopic surgery or a scope, I believe, and I just decided to take some time off and, you know, work on my body and stuff like that.
But that's freaking 16 for that to happen. That's scary and could be a turnoff, so it's cool that you still ended up coming back. But were you, so by the time you were 18, you said you were working out over those 2 years. Is that when you got like huge into bodybuilding, or were you already like big into it before that?
No, you know what? I had weightlifting as my first period class in the 10th grade, and I never did shit. Like literally and this was before I decided I was going to be a wrestler though. Once I decided I was going to be a wrestler, that's when I kind of took it on as it's just a part of the business. It's kind of what we grew up on. All the guys were big and looked like the comic books, and you know what I mean? Or were 250-300 pounds. So, I never liked bodybuilding. I never really cared for anything like that. But then I did take it up as a hobby, mainly towards pro wrestling. But I did really like follow the Mr. Olympias, and I read all, you know, Flex, Muscle Mag, all those magazines. I worked at a Muscle Mag store that was in Santa Monica before I got signed. So I was and I was in Venice, California, obviously. So I was very entrenched in the whole culture of it. And, it became a hobby. Yes.
And of course, you're in UPW, which had a working relationship with WWF at the time. And you got their attention. You were really young, right, when you started with Ohio Valley?
Yeah. Like, they saw me through UPW when I was 18 years old, because when I came back, I was already in great shape. So, and I could move for a big guy, which was pretty rare, at least around that time. So, I caught their attention, and I was on their radar, I think, for the next year or so. And then they ended up signing me I think I was still 18 when they signed me. I might have turned 19, and then pretty much, I was in OVW from 19 till I debuted. You know what I mean? Basically, that was the start.
Were you shocked at how quick everything happened? I mean, a year is, for the most part, I mean, it's, at that time, I mean, it's kind of unheard of to make it that quick. It's few and far between for that to happen.
Well, you know, I had faced kind of my own little struggles on my way there, because I mean, also I had tried out for Tough Enough one time and I made it to the second round. I flew to Denver, and John Morrison actually was on that one too. We actually reminisce about that every once in a while, and I didn't make it past that next round. So it was always, for me, it was back to the drawing board. It was the same thing when I went to wrestling school and then I got hurt. It was like, all right, you know, I'm not quitting, but it's kind of back to the drawing board. What do I need to work on? And then I'll come back and get it. So, you know, I did have face some adversity, but, you know, in my mind, I was always convinced that this was what I was meant to do. And when it did happen real fast, but it wasn't real shocking to me because I feel like I had, you know, I had failed a couple of times and I had reevaluated everything and, you know, and eventually things worked out. And that's the only way I saw it happening. So I was definitely grateful, but I wasn't necessarily shocked, you know, just for whatever reason, because of that process and because of my mindset.
And then at that time, Ohio Valley was just off the heels of producing so much awesome talent. And it might have been the peak of OVW. Who was the head trainer when you were there? What was the experience like at OVW for you?
Oh, man. Looking back now, it was might have been the best times of my career. I mean, it's a time, for me, it was like college going in at that age, obviously, going in at 19 years old and, you know, being around the OVW wrestling scene, which was very old school. You know, it was Jim Cornette, Danny Davis, and Rip Rogers was the trainer. But, you know, it was a culture shock, but it was just really interesting. You know, you just got there and you realized that you weren't in, that you're not in Los Angeles anymore. I mean, in terms of like Jim Cornette, you know, would not let baby faces hang out with heels. It was very old school, you know, everything about it, the atmosphere around it, the guys involved with it. But it made it a lot of fun. I didn't know what to expect going to Kentucky, you know, because it's Kentucky. But we had such a good group. You know, there's about 30 of us, you know, 20 of us signed, maybe 12 that weren't. And it was a tight-knit group, and everybody kind of lived within the same quarters, and everybody hung out together. And, you know, it was the last bit of innocence you have, too, before you go up to the main roster, and there's so much money involved, and there's politics and all that stuff. So, you know, you can always look back at that as, you know, a much more time of innocence and just, you know, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed.
Hat, when you first got there, being 19 years old and young, jacked up dude, did a lot of people were people warm to you, or were they kind of like, "Oh, this young kid doesn't deserve to be here"?
No. Kind of thing? No, not at all, man. Everybody, it took me a long time to win a lot of people over because exactly what you just said, being a young, jacked up kid who was kind of getting a lot thrown at him, you know, it creates resentment, especially towards a lot of people who've been working real hard and. You know, that's just, you can understand where they're coming from. But, so, I mean, they weren't quick to warm up to me, but, you know, with time, people get to know you, your personality, and, you know, the walls started coming down a bit and, you know, people, I think they realized I wasn't, you know, a total douchebag.
When, you know, yeah. And at 6'4", you know, and, you know, probably 250 pounds at the time, you know, you had a lot of potential, and you probably were looked at a little bit differently than maybe some of the other recruits. And at some point, you become the masterpiece. Now, we've had Matt Morgan on before, and he's been given credit for coming up with a masterpiece gimmick. Is that how you remember it?
Yeah, because we were sitting around. It was like hanging out, just like I was just saying. It was Matt. It was me, Matt, like Chris Cage. And not Christian Cage, but Chris Cage, Chris Pavone. And I think probably even Mickey James. And they had come up with the name Masters for me. You know, they didn't want to go with Mordetsky. So they came up with Masters. And then Matt Morgan had just come up with Masterpiece while we were just all sitting around hanging out. And, you know, it was just the light bulb went off. It was perfect. And, you know, I made sure to pitch it the next day to Jim Cornette and all the powers to be. And then, you know, Chris Masters turned into the masterpiece, Chris Masters, the master of the master lock.
And when someone comes to you and you find out, because of course the goal, the dream is to get to the big show up there. And at some point somebody says, "Chris, it's happening. It's going to happen. You're the masterpiece." Who's the one who breaks the news to you, and how did you take it?
Well, it didn't really, there wasn't any definitive moment, I don't think, where anybody just told me, like, "Hey, this is the deal." It's just the next thing I knew, I was on the road. You know, like, I was working the OVW TVs, and, you know, the next thing I know, Tommy Dreamer would just call me and be like, "Hey, Masters, you're on the road this weekend." And, you know, I would I'd do the Chris Masters thing. I'd work the house shows and then go back to Louisville every week. And I did that for about, over a half a year. And, I'd work dark matches at television. And then the next thing I knew, they were shipping me off to shoot pre-tapes in Connecticut. And then, the next thing I know, they're rolling the pre-tapes every week. And then fast forward, I debut about a couple months later. So, I mean, everything was real incremental as far as each step. It wasn't just one day I was out of Louisville and on television.
Well, and, I remember because I was at the time doing extra stuff for WWE, and I was an extra at Raw. And I'm like, I mean, you confirm it now, but I'm like 99% sure it was your debut. And did you have food poisoning?
Yeah, you were there.
I was there. I was an extra. Where was that? What city was that?
Oh, my God. It was in Pennsylvania.
Yes, I was there because I'm from Jersey. And I remember it was your debut. And everybody, I guess that's how I found out, because people were talking about it in the back and they were saying you were laying down. I remember seeing you lay down. But everybody was saying how, yeah, you were like throwing up and like whatever. And you had to debut that night.
Oh, yeah. It was the sickest I've ever. I can't believe you were actually there. It's, that's unbelievable. It was the sickest I've ever been in my life. I've never had food poisoning to that degree. And how inconvenient of a day to have it too, right? Like,
what was it from?
I you know what? And I tell people this all the time, like, our fellow wrestlers, our peers, when they travel, to watch out for any of those sandwiches you get at a truck stop or a gas station. I ended up getting... We had a long drive the night before. It was like a 5-hour drive or something like that. And I remember I was starving, so I picked up a turkey wrap at like a gas station or a truck stop. It was like our only option to eat. And I ate it. And all I know is the next morning, my stomach was rumbling. And I went down to the lobby, to the restaurant to eat breakfast like I normally do. And I mean, I couldn't even take two bites. Took maybe two bites and I was done. I was just tapped out. And then, I think it was after that we went to go tanning, and that's when I started throwing up. And, the whole day it was just, I couldn't hold down anything, man. I was throwing up. I was crapping. I was a mess. I mean, I couldn't believe it. And I think I lost 10 pounds by the time I actually debuted, honestly, just because of dehydration and not being able to eat and being sick.
So you do make your
debut. I made my debut, and then that it was that match where I infamously broke Stevie Richards' nose and its orbital bone. So all in all, it was not a great start.
That is not it is auspicious, but for you to have this debut with all the vignettes at 21 years old, 22 years old. Is that about right?
Yeah, well, I was 21.
Oh, my goodness. And all that, a lot of pressure. Who was the person giving you the direction? I mean, obviously, they put a lot into it as far as the vignettes and the timing and how it's going to work. Who's the person who was kind of the Chris Masters guy when you got up there?
Funny enough, as you say that, the day of my debut, it was... Sean and Hunter that were working with me on my entrance, specifically, I was sick as a dog, but I was up there and I was working with them, and they were walking me through, we were walking through different routines to do up on the top of the ramp. And, they helped out a lot, but, there were many people who helped out in terms of also the wrestling aspect, being like, the enforcer, Arn Anderson, and, Fit Finley, but, it feels like a lot of different people had their hands in, my development there, but I do remember that day, Sean and Hunter and me walking through, opposing routine to the song, that became my entrance, for that period.
That's a great
story. And, so you got this grand entrance. You got the vignettes building you up, and then you start doing the thing where you call guys out of the audience and you beat them. So you're on every week. You're clearly they're into you. You're getting this cool push. Did you think like this was going to go on to be, world champion? Like, what were your first thoughts when you saw you were getting wins and getting the push?
It was all so surreal, man. I was just, it's one of those things where in the moment, I think you can only look back after and reflect on it and be like, oh, you know, wow, that really happened. But, it seemed like the sky was the limit, honestly. I mean, I know they were trying to, push me towards that direction. It's hard in terms of working with Cena and all that. But I mean, one thing I learned with pro wrestling is, you know, they might tell you one thing one day and that could change within the next week, let alone even the next day or even the next hour. So, you know, there was a lot of touch and go, you know, and it started right from the start. I mean, when I injured Stevie Richards, I was just on heat for the next month and a half to make sure I didn't, you know, their B show at the time, to make sure I didn't hurt anybody, I think. And then a lot of interesting things happened. Like even in Taboo, like during this time, we had Taboo Tuesday, which sure. I think you guys might remember that pay-per-view where they draw people. So I was teaming up with Gene Snitsky and against whoever the fans picked, they picked for that match. I think it was Rey Mysterio and Matt Hardy. And Vince was real adamant about me not getting pins, but nobody had told us. So we put the match together in a fashion where I ended up taking the pinfall, you know. And then, so we did the match. The match turned out great. But then when we got to the back, Vince was going crazy because he didn't want me to get pinned, because I guess the whole plan was they wanted to keep me strong, I guess, to work with Cena in that next month or towards the Survivor Series area. But nobody had told us. So we just put the match together, and John Laurinaitis had sworn that he had told me that I was not the one to take the fall. And, you know, so that little circumstance right there, I think, kind of hurt things. And then there's a series of others. But
so at your young age and, you know, all this pressure and all the success, Chris Masters is kicking all kinds of ass. You're dealing with Shawn Michaels. You're in the pay-per-views. How is Chris Mordetsky handling all this?
I grew up idolizing Shawn Michaels, first of all. So just the idea that I was going into a program with him was like a dream come true for me. I mean, you might as well have just told me I was winning the world title, because, I mean, to me, that was the greatest wrestler I've ever seen, greatest in-ring performer. So what was going through my mind is I was just so excited every week to see what it is we were going to be doing. But I mean, it was also, there were a lot of nerves. It was very, you know, on one hand, it was very exciting, but it was also very stressful. And I just remember, I kept telling myself, especially like leading up to my first program was with Shawn Michaels. So like we were saying, so I kept telling myself leading into the pay-per-view with him, God, just make sure you're not the only guy in history to have a bad pay-per-view match with HBK.
Right.
So and you know, also for myself, just because, you know, it's just something I'm going to always want to look back on, and I'm going to want to have a positive memory of it. So, you know, a lot of shock, a lot of just, I mean, you got to understand too, like when I came in the first time, it was all guys I had kind of grown up watching. So it wasn't like the second time I got there when there were a lot of guys, newer guys who had kind of started around my generation. I mean, I came in there with the Shawn Michaels, the Ric Flairs, the Hunter Hearst Helmsley, the Val Venus, like, you know, just all those guys.
And so the first time you said, because you did get released once, what led to that? What do you think is the reason that happened?
Because I had messed up on the, you know, I'd already popped on the wellness policy. And then I was a second time offender. And like all this stuff happened at one time. I ended up, I was in Europe and I ended up fracturing my elbow, or no, dislocating my elbow. And then I was sent home at the end of a tour, basically, because I couldn't finish it. And then by the time I got home, I was told that I also had popped on the test. So, and at first they were just going to overlook it. And basically that's what they told me. It's no big deal. You take your 60 days and then you come back. But around that time, I mean, I don't know if a lot of people remember, but that was right around the time of like Eddie and Chris Benoit. And there was a lot of heat on the company, and it went from basically taking your 60-day suspension to, hey, we got to let you go. So, you know, that's what basically happened around that time frame.
And the backlash off of the Benoit in particular situation, you know, led to that heightened, you know, focus on abuse and, you know, performance enhancement drugs and all that.
That's one thing I want to clarify though too, is a lot of people always think automatically that it was performance enhancing drugs or steroids with me, when my problem around that time, I didn't have a problem with steroids. My problem was painkillers and basically prescription pills. So, and that was the demons I was battling at that time. It wasn't that, Chris Masters couldn't stay off of testosterone for 2 months to pass a drug test. No, it wasn't anything like that. It was like I had personal issues with those prescription pills, and which a lot of people are facing today, obviously.
That is a, you know, misconception I think a lot of people have, an assumption, because you were a body guy, you know, and then you fail the test. You know, I think people unfairly, and I guess I,
oh, can, yeah,
you know, for yourself being, oh, yeah, coming in with, I mean, right to Shawn Michaels, all of, you know, Taboo. I mean, really, you're at the very top of the card. A lot of people, we talked about OVW and how maybe they weren't as welcoming to the young kid. Did you have any problems in WWE, maybe relating to not understanding all these unspoken locker room rules, or maybe the immaturity, or maybe some jealousy? Were there any issues?
Oh yeah, big time. I didn't even know the first time I went to SmackDown taping, because at the time when I was in OVW, everybody wanted to go to Raw, but it wasn't just because Raw was Raw. It was also because Raw had a different crew. Like SmackDown was built up of like JBL and Bob Holly and a lot of the kind of older veterans around that time that were known for kind of giving young guys a hard time, just like what you were just saying. And yeah, I had a big problem as far as learning all the unwritten rules and etiquette of wrestling. I mean, Bob Holly basically wanted to kill me at my first SmackDown taping, because he already had a bad impression of me from OVW, because I had missed the first OVW TV taping, which is a whole nother story. But I was doing the whole shaking hands thing of everybody, and for whatever chance, I had missed Bob Holly in the locker room, and I think it's because he was amongst a group of people and they were talking, and then Bob Holly took it as a sign of disrespect and basically called me out. He started yelling at me in the locker room, and he tried to change his dark match that night from him versus Carlito to him versus me. And it was a real uncomfortable scene. I left that TV taping not knowing if I would, if I got called up to SmackDown, if I'd even make it up there.
It seems...
Who's calling?
I think Robbie's making phone
calls.
Yeah,
sir. Hey,
it seems, as a fan, it seems silly to me, these rules. You know, and I understand you want to show respect. But as a kid, dude, you're a kid going in. You're not going to fucking forget to shake Bob Holly's hands on purpose. How silly is it that a guy like that uses something like that as a way to not want to work with you or to talk bad about you? Or it seems like there might be more going on there than just a handshake.
Well, it goes back to some of the things you were saying before about a young guy coming in, you know what I mean? Like automatically when there's been guys who have been up there a long time who have spots. I mean, you know, you see that and I think their automatic impulse is to worry about this person taking their spot, or they have resentment for somebody getting a push. I'm not necessarily saying that's what they were feeling at the time, but, you know, a lot of those things play factors into all that type of stuff. But there is use for some of, you know, like, being a veteran and being involved in this business as long as I have, I do see the need for some of these, you know, the handshaking and just showing respect to the guys who kind of paved the way for you, which I know you understand as well, but... I'm sorry. Hang on. I got somebody ringing the doorbell here. Okay. Go ahead. I'm sorry, guys.
So when you're in the locker room, you're new to SmackDown, and Bob Holly's yelling at you in front of everyone, what is your reaction? What do you do?
I couldn't believe it. Like I said, I I couldn't believe it. I was.
But you don't say anything back. You knew just to eat it, and you can't say anything because you'll get in trouble.
Oh yeah, but it goes and yeah, definitely. And it also just like we were just saying. I mean, I had the utmost. I couldn't even believe that he thought I disrespected him because to me, I looked up to all these guys. I was like, wow, these like are all the guys who I've watched throughout my whole lifetime, and I didn't have any disrespect towards anybody. It was just, you know, the way I looked and probably the fact that I might have kept to myself or been, you know, like shy might have just rubbed people the wrong way, and specifically Bob. I mean, like I said, I left SmackDown that day not knowing if I would even last if I ended up getting called up there. I was really worried.
On the other side...
And hopeful that I...
Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, I guess on the other side, was there a veteran that would... You know, maybe put their arm around you and be like, dude, it's cool. This stuff happens. Here's what you got to do. Anybody take you under their wing as far as maybe maneuvering beyond the backstage stuff?
Oh, yeah, certainly. One guy that just automatically pops in my head is Viscera, King Mabel, whatever you would want to call him. God rest his soul. But he was... definitely a veteran who throughout my whole time up there, especially that first run, was really there to just kind of wisen me up and, you know, let me in a little bit on what is happening. Because, you know, like we were saying, there's so many unwritten rules and so many things that you don't know coming in as a kid that you kind of got to follow. And you need somebody to kind of like, you know, smarten you up, as they say. And Viscera was that guy a lot of times for me because he's been around. He's seen it all. I mean, he's been through it all, and he was just always a great guy to me and a great guy to have around in the locker room.
And then at some point in that first run, you also get a three-way match with Angle and Cena where it was for the world title. So at that point, how are you feeling in such a huge match?
I think everything was just moving so fast at that point. I didn't really stop to you know, process the fact that, oh, this is a world title match, as opposed to any other match I was having, just because, you know, at that point, everything was just happening quick, and every day was a different match with somebody. You know, if it wasn't the Survivor Series, it was the Elimination Chamber. If it wasn't that, it was the three-man that you were just talking about, or it was a Master Lock Challenge with Sean, or, you know, like...
You're probably looking back at all this. You probably look at all this back now and like say, like, was that even really me doing it all? Like, it happened so quick, right?
Oh yeah, and it just feels like it feels like a lifetime ago now. So like when I see the pictures, excuse me, I just try to relate to my mindset at that time, and it's just like I can't even put myself there anymore. It's unbelievable.
So when you got released, did you think, okay, I'm done with WWE forever? Did you actually think at some point you were going to get a second chance? Did you say, I'm going to try, you know, to go to TNA? Like, what was going through your head at that time?
I definitely always felt like I was going to come back. I didn't really have any doubt about that. Just because of the way it all ended, I just knew I needed to get my stuff together and I needed to get myself straight. Get myself off the prescription pills. But I mean, over the next couple of years, I did really enjoy some of my most fond memories in the business in terms of my first time being on the indie scene, working, you know, these various tours like for NWE and American Rampage. So I definitely really enjoyed my life outside of WWE, but I always kind of knew in the back of my mind and eventually at the forefront that was definitely something I had to do and was going to do because I didn't want to leave it the way it had ended, just like that.
Now, a lot's been made of Triple H's comment to you on air about, you know, how to lose, you know, whatever it was, this amount of pounds in this many days. And you've kind of attributed it to, you know, Triple H not being malicious and, you know, kind of being a ball buster. But considering where you were, considering that you're coming back from, you know, painkillers and all that, it seems a little off to me, at least. Is that a line you knew that was coming?
Yeah, it was a pre-planned line. And yeah, I mean, I've heard people have brought this up for years. I mean, believe me, I've heard it time and time again. I guess you can take it however you want. I mean, I just look at some of Triple H's other actions in terms of even with his own friends, like in terms of what he says. Like even when he inducted Shawn into the Hall of Fame, he was talking about the googly eyes. So, I mean, I look at his actions with his friends and other people, and, you know, it makes me want to believe that, like, you know, he wasn't completely malicious in that moment, and it was just something to, you know, stir up the internet marks because it was something they were talking about, you know what I mean? But, you know, a lot of people bring it up to me still to this day and ask me if it was offensive. So at that point in time, I mean, I was really, I mean, like I said, I was just fighting to keep myself clean and sober, and I didn't really, you know, I didn't really process that as something that was upsetting at that point. You know, I'm sure deep down it might have been, but I don't know. It's not something I carry with me or I hold a grudge about or I'm upset about.
And, of course, there's also another comment that JBL said.
Here's one other thing I want to say, too. As much as we have close relationships with people in the business through shared experiences and whatnot, one thing you don't look for out of your peers in professional wrestling is sympathy. That's one thing I've learned. You just don't. It's not a place you look for it. So, you know, I take that stuff in mind when it comes to, you know, comments like that, or just like if I'm going through a hard time, I don't expect anybody in the business to put their arm around me, so to speak.
Robbie, is that your experience, that no one's very sympathetic to you?
I mean, I agree with him completely on that. I'd say 100%. It's pretty much, you know, you have friends, but are they really your friends? And everyone's got to worry about their own shit. So it's kind of just like, yeah, I agree. There's no sympathy.
And there was another comment that JBL said about, you know, somebody else that, you know, he looked like he's from a concentration camp, which is a great thing to say. Then he said he's as skinny as Chris Masters. A shitty thing to say, but what was your relationship like with JBL in the WWE? Was he one of those veteran ballbusters?
Did he say that? I never even caught that.
Yeah, I believe he did say that. I believe there's a match with someone against Marty Garner, who he said the guy's so skinny, he's like from a concentration camp. He's as skinny as Chris Masters.
Wow. You know what? I wasn't even aware of that. Well, yeah, JBL was a big headache for me. He was like one of the guys on SmackDown that gave me the hardest time. I had my first trip to Afghanistan. He was in the same group as me. I mean, he made my life a living hell. I mean, he's definitely the local or the WWE hazer at the time. But, you know, it was just one of those things that, you know, you have to deal with. Like we were talking about earlier, I mean, I just kind of had to take it and shut my mouth at the time, although it had probably been better to Joey Styles him. Although that story, you know, that happened the way it was supposed to. I mean, that was a storybook kind of thing right there. But, yeah, he made my life hell, man. He really fucked with my head a lot, and he just really tried to mind fuck me and break me down. But, you know, he wasn't successful, I'll say that.
Did you see the JBL and Styles thing?
No, man, I wish I was on that flight. I think that was actually the year that I had gotten released. So, I mean, I've heard the story quite a few times, and it is amazing.
So you came back, and how did you see that your position had changed, or did you?
Oh, I certainly did. I didn't get the push I had the first time. So I felt like I was on probation from the very start in terms of, you know, is he going to mess up again, or can we invest in him, or, you know, so, but for me, quite frankly, I had a different mindset at that time, and I just had so much gratitude just to be back at that point, and I had overcome the things that I had overcome that I wasn't too preoccupied or worried about necessarily where my spot was, at least initially. So I was just, you know, just happy to be back and happy to be working with the company and whatnot.
Was it a lot different from when you were there the first time?
Oh, yeah. I mean, everything was different. The crew was already much different by that point. Just everything in terms of, you know, I wasn't used in a in the main spot. So I was booked on all the house shows, but, you know, I wasn't doing necessarily on television at that point, or on the main roster, or, you know, on Raw.
And then, yeah, you turned babyface, right?
Oh, yeah.
And then what was your feeling on that? Like, because that was your first time in WWE as a babyface, right?
Well, it was cool because, I mean, the last couple of years, like, again, I wasn't used, like, in any primary storylines, but I was booked on everything. And around those couple of years were the couple of years I just really devoted to working on the in-ring craft and dissecting it every week, everything that I'd done the week before, and seeing what I liked and disliked, and just really trying to up my game in the ring and not be just this, you know, that old stereotype of body guy who can't wrestle, because I had heard that for so many years, and I really wanted to prove that to not be true, you know, because, you know, I wasn't some just bodybuilder who came in trying to capitalize on that and be a pro wrestler. I loved pro wrestling my whole life, and I only ever stepped into a gym to achieve pro wrestling career. So, you know, I really took it as a big thing for me to, you know, become a good in-ring professional wrestler, a good worker, as they say, and have good matches with everybody, and really understand the art of it, the art of storytelling, the art of selling, you know, the emotion, the theater aspect of it. Because, I mean, it really is, when you break it down, you know, it's theater in there, and it can be beautiful when it's done right.
When you were brought back, you know, you weren't really... you know, as you said, your position had changed. why did they bring you back? Do you think you were just going to be like a body, someone to use in the mid card? Or do you think maybe if you showed them a little something, you know, you would be able to get back on top? Looking back, do you think you had a shot to kind of reach those heights again? Or you think it was, you know, we're making an example out of Chris Masters?
I'm not sure. I mean, I worked my ass off. I tried, like I said, I worked so hard on my craft. After a certain point, I wasn't just happy to be there. I obviously wanted to do something. So I worked my ass off in terms of just doing whatever I could from my end to try to put myself in a favorable position. But I don't know if at that point they had already made up their mind, or also you can only be booked a certain way for so long before wrestling fans won't accept you as, you know, a main event guy, or even a guy, you know, wrestling for the Intercontinental title or anything like that. So I felt like, you know, kind of either way, after a certain point, I needed to either leave and go away for a while just to, you know, reinvent myself, or just to, you know, wash away what they had, the way they had booked me for the last couple of years. But I mean, I will say this, throughout that whole time, I mean, Hunter himself had come up to me on several occasions telling me, acknowledging how good I had gotten in the ring and how we needed to do something. They wanted to do something with me in terms of, but they needed to put a fresh coat of paint on me, so to speak, is what he said. So, you know, it was put out there for a while that we should do something with Chris Masters, and they did have me start winning a majority of my matches that were on Superstars, granted, but, you know, so I did have some optimism there towards the end that maybe there is something that can be done, or maybe I can be used somehow up here.
And then, how did it, the second time, how did it come to an end?
It was just, you know, it was abrupt. The only last things I remember is, I had been cooking for a good 3 months. They had had me winning a lot of the matches I was working in, but then I was booked to work Jack Swagger on my last TV show.
Are you still there? I think we lost you, Chris. Hello? Robbie, are you there?
I'm here. Yeah, Chris, you there?
So, let me hang up this call, and I'll call you, and then I'll call him again.
Okay.
Sound good?
Yeah.
All right, man.
I cut out.
Oh, it happens. It happens. Yeah. You were in the middle of your story.
I know where to start it from.
Cool.
So the last thing I remembered when I was up there, for the last TV taping I was at, I had been cooking for the previous months prior. They had put me over in a lot of the matches I'd worked in. I'd had conversations with Hunter, and there was a consensus that I had really gotten to be a good in-ring performer, and that they would do something with me or look to be doing something with me. But at the last taping I was booked to work Jack Swagger. I was booked to go over. And then somewhere in the middle of the match, I guess they had switched to finish, which they had done before. They had done it in my favor the times before, but, you know, it's still an odd thing that it even happened. But they switched to finish, and they told us in the ring to put Jack Swagger over. So, but, you know, no big deal. So we did that. And then it was the next Friday after the taping that I just got the phone call that I was being let go. So, you know, was it like, nothing concrete really happened or anything like that. It was just as quick as that. And I mean, it definitely caught me by surprise, and I wasn't necessarily happy, but you know, that's life.
Were you told that there's nothing for you at this time? The door's always open. That's kind of the couple things we usually hear. Is that basically what you were told?
You know, when you're getting the conversation, it's hard to even hear the words that they're saying, because I mean, you know what they're getting to. The best I can recall, I think it was just something like, we don't have anything for you. But at that point in the conversation, it was just sounded like, blah, 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 you're fired.
And so at this point, so for the second time this happening, now what's going through your head? Like, now are you saying, all right, maybe now I won't have a third shot there. I need to figure out what I'm going to do with my career.
I've never thought about a third shot there, really. I mean, it's not to say that I wouldn't entertain it if it was presented to me, of course, because, I mean, we're still pro wrestlers. That's what we do, and that's the grandest company there is. But, no, it's just, it's never been once. I mean, it took me a while to process it after the second time it happened, but, you know, I carried on just like I did the first time, and, I've just never kind of really entertained the idea of, you know, it's just a completely different thing this time. Like last time, it was in my mind that I was going to go back and I was going to, you know, like, you know, get redemption from the time before. But then, you know, this last time that it happened, definitely not the same. It was, you know, not even a thought I was entertaining, and it's still not something I really even entertain at this point.
And shortly after that, because I know you had a few matches for TNA, like kind of right when you left, because I remember wrestling you in a dark match. Why did whatever happened? Yeah, like why did, because you had that cool armor piece that you came out with and stuff. You remember that?
Yeah, I don't know. I think you didn't do me right in that match or something, man. What happened?
Well, they moved us up like 3 hours. We were supposed to be last. Do you remember that? And like, I didn't even have tape on, and they were like, "You guys got to go out now." They told us like 5 minutes before. I didn't have oil on. I didn't have anything.
That's so pro wrestling of them to do too. Like, I've never seen anywhere where they like, because that's happened before to me where. You're supposed to be on somewhere else, and then all of a sudden you're on first, and it's like you got 5 minutes, and you don't even have your boots on. It's like a nightmare.
Yeah,
Robbie, you only brought that up because you beat him, right?
It's probably the only match I ever won. I think it's the only match I ever won in TNA.
Yeah.
I remember Al Snow having to apologize to you saying that you were going to lose in that match. Because it was like my only win.
To
only
him.
Because you were in contract. But why, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, why did it end up not panning out with you and TNA at that time?
You know, I'm not even sure about that either. You know what I mean? I mean, I left there with a good, excuse me. I left there with a good impression thinking that might be something I might do, but I mean, Robbie, you know how it is. I mean, nobody really gives you, it's rare in wrestling that you get any clear cut answer on anything. I mean, usually it's something where they're beating around the bush or you just don't hear anything.
And, you know, something I remember a couple years ago is that you were announced as part of Global, you know, the Jeff Jarrett company. But you guys, I mean, you guys did the baseball stadium tour, but not a lot happened with that. Do you think that was kind of something that maybe was a missed opportunity for you, either by going there or by it not really panning out the way that we all thought it could?
No, not necessarily, because I think just being around pro wrestling this long that you don't put too much stock in any one thing, because you see all these promotions, excuse me, that start up and, you know, they have all these big intentions and they have all this money. And they, excuse me, I got something in my throat. And they just don't end up, they don't end up panning out in the end, or they go out of business, or, you know, you can't get your hopes up.
And that led to a couple little stints in TNA. What's your overall impression of course, you did, you know, like Team Global versus Team TNA, and then you did some stuff with them in 2017, 2018. Is that just not a place where they were, like, really wanted to commit to you, or was it just not a situation where it was going to pan out for a long time?
Well, for me personally, I wasn't making enough money to invest the amount of time that they wanted me to. I mean, we only worked, TNA was only filling 4 days out of a 3 month schedule. And so for the amount of money that they were wanting to pay me in order to put in through these 8 hour days where we film multiple TVs, and then on top of it, I'm not even being really highlighted or booked in a way that's going to help me with my outside work. All those factors being accounted for, it just made it not worth it for me to even show up to work. So, I mean, on my last set of TV tapings with Impact, literally on the third day of TV tapings, I just booked a flight and left. And I told them when I arrived home in Toronto that I won't be arriving at work that day, because I was just like, you know, this isn't worth it, my time. And I don't believe in what we're doing. I don't like the way I'm being booked. I didn't like anything about it. So I basically hit them with the peace out.
Did you have thought into this, or like that morning you just woke up and said, fuck it, I'm out of here?
Well, the night before I had thought it over, and I was just like, I had made up my decision. I was like, you know, I don't even want to go into work tomorrow. And, you know, so I just really, it just came down to the fact that, there's nothing really binding me to this company in terms of, you know, I have really no investment in it, and, the payoff isn't worth my time. So, I mean, it was literally, you know, that was it.
So nowadays, I mean, I know you're still busy. You go overseas a lot still, but so are you pretty much actively wrestling every weekend?
Yeah. I mean, it's a good time for pro wrestling. I mean, I'm sure, as you know, too, you know, with the business is very hot again right now. You know, you've got the independent wrestling, New Japan, everything is really booming. You got All In, which was a huge thing for the whole business, really, because I mean, when something like All In is successful, I think everybody kind of that's involved with pro wrestling wins. It's more work for everybody, because all that is, you know, these guys went out and set off on a successful business venture, and then other people who are wanting to potentially start their pro wrestling businesses are going to look at that, and you know, it just triggers work for everybody, because you get all these startup promotions and businesses, and you know, pro wrestling's hot. So you know, it's led to a lot of work for me within the last, you know, half year. But, I mean, you know, the wrestling business is been pretty good to me overall, just since I've, gotten into it. I mean, there's always been a, healthy dose of work. There's, you know, hot patches and cold patches, but it tends to stay pretty consistent.
And, you know, from what you were saying earlier, you're traveling all over. You're still taking bookings. You're 35 years old. You got a lot of wrestling left. Big career ahead of you. If people want to get a hold of you for bookings or reach out on social media, how does someone get a hold of Chris Masters, Chris Adonis, the Masterpiece?
Well, so on the social media platforms, it's Chris Masters 310, that being Twitter and Instagram. And then, you know, I'm always accepting bookings over email at masterpiece83@gmail.com. So, you know, it's a beautiful day and age we live in where we're so accessible. I mean, that's a beauty and a curse at the same time, I guess.
Yeah. Hey, man, well, thanks so much for doing this, bro. We definitely really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, guys. I appreciate you having me.
How funny everything is. Now, when I do my fake laugh and you do your real laugh, are you really laughing or are you fake laughing?
I'm laughing at you fake laughing.
I can make you laugh whenever I want, just by laughing. Is that the way it works?
Okay. Pretty much.
Robbie, we just heard Chris Masters. We've been kind of going back and forth with him on the texting and the contacting. We finally got him on the show. He did not disappoint. I don't want to say his story is like tragic because he's so young. He's got so much wrestling career ahead of him, but I'm not sure he really got a fair deal, dude.
Yeah, I mean, he did have two opportunities, and you know, like you said, he's not bitter, and he was still happy about his time there. Could he have had other opportunities while he was there? Maybe they'd done more with him, sure, but a lot of guys could say that. So I still think he's a memorable character, and you know, I mean, Chris Masters is someone you remember. It's not like he was a nobody there,
dude. Chris Masters was somebody we definitely remember. That big push, and all the stuff he talked about, you know, is another guy with a tough enough connection. And of course, never the same after losing to Robbie E. So I thought Chris Masters was fantastic. I hope he met the expectations of the fans out there. Of course, as Robbie announced earlier, he is on the Titan Games. And
that's right.
We are on Wyatt Edit. Of course, check out our YouTube at WhereItEdit.com. Check us out on social media. Guys, get on that Patreon because we're adding more stuff every single day. And Robbie, what closing words do you have for our wonderful listeners out there?
I mean, you both need to get some sleep. Good night, guys.
On Wyatt Edit.